The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Today we have Paola Bonifazio, who is an associate professor and chair of the Department of French and Italian at the University of Texas at Austin. She received her PhD in Italian Studies from New York University in 2008 and her master's in Italian and Film Studies from the University of Pittsburgh in 2003. In 2011, she was the NEH Andrew Mellon Rome Prize Fellow at the American Academy in Rome. Her research interests focus on film and media theory and history, cultural studies, gender studies, and feminist and post-feminist theories. Her first book, Schooling in Modernity, The Politics of Sponsored Films in Postwar Italy, published by the University of Toronto Press in 2014, explores short film productions sponsored by state and non-state agencies to promote modernization and industry and to govern the Italian people's conduct. A very interesting book, that too. But today we will be discussing her second book, The Photo Romance, a feminist reading of popular culture, which has been just published by the MIT Press this year, 2020. In this book, she examines the convergence culture of Italian media as photo romance magazines disperse their content across multiple formats, narrative conventions, editorial, and business strategies and platforms. I also want to say that Paola is an associate editor of Gender Sexuality Italy, a peer-reviewed academic journal on gendered identities, discourses, and practices in the Italian context. And I had the pleasure to have her as a colleague there, as an associate editor. So I'm really very happy to have you here today, Paola.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So the Photo Romance, a feminist reading of popular culture. This title is really very interesting. I read it with a lot of pleasure, interest, kind of guilt, and even regret. But I will explain later because I have a lot of questions to ask you. But first of all, there are, you know, many different words that in this title, perspectives and contexts, which are really considered usually different, if not antagonistic, photo romance, feminism, and popular culture in general. So let's start from the first term, the photo romance, which is the object of study of your book. So as you explain in the book, the photo romance is an Italian-born cultural product, then exported in the rest of the world. Some of our listeners may find it a bit difficult to identify this product, this genre, or this medium, as we want to call it. So can you explain what a photo romance is and give our listeners some historical context? I am particularly interested in its being a transmedial cultural product. So can you explain this?
The photo romance is a type of comics that uses photographs instead of drawings. And as you said, it was born in Italy in the late 1940s, and then it was exported abroad pretty quickly and became pretty quickly popular, particularly in France and then all over Europe and as well as in South America. The term sometimes is referred to as photo novel in English. The Italian term is photo romanzo. In French, roman photo. In Spanish, fotonovela. And I use the term photo romance because this is the word that is used in publication that came out in the United States in the 1970s, which were imported narratives from Italy published by a Roman company, Lancio. So this is a type of comics, as I said, and so it draws from the tradition, especially of romantic drawings and comics magazine that were published in the late 40s already in Italy, but also draws from a tradition of film melodrama, especially in its narratives. They are very frequently romantic stories. That's the topic of the content of the photo romance, as the very word photo romance says. And as well as the term transmedia, it perfectly applies in this context because not only it's a comic magazine that uses photographs, so it uses some of the techniques imported from cinema, but also the content of these magazines went across media platform as it features, for example, movie stars or celebrities from the television, as well as contain advertisement for music records. So it really branched. The publisher of these magazines were also very important one, like Mondadori and Rizzoli in Italy. And in France, there were franchises of Italian publishers or local publishers. And they very often had business connection with other industries in other media. So really the term transmedia applies to the photo romance at various levels. So at the level of narrative and at the level of the market, as well as the level of production. You can say that there was these publishers were so-called integrated firms. They had branches across media platforms.
So it's not really a genre. It's not only a medium or only a genre. It's a bit something of everything, some of everything.
Well, what I do in the book is I do start from the photo romance as a type of publication. But what I do is precisely to show that the photo romance is not only this historical, you know, has this existence as a type of magazine, but also it exists as a medium as it was used by other producer, so not only by publisher, but I don't know, in the book, for example, I talk about the way in which the Communist Party or the Catholic magazine Familia Cristiana used the photo romance as a medium to convey messages that could be either the spreading of the gospel or convincing women to vote for the Communist Party. I guess one of the goal of the book is precisely to show how broad was the success of these type of comics, so that it really became pervasive at the time and throughout the 1970s until the mid-80s in Italian society, but also internationally because of its international success.
Yeah, I remember that success very clearly, actually. So, but what inspired you to start your research on photoromance?
So, the reason why I started to work on it is I was particularly interested in the contrast between the success of the magazines and at the same time, the very sharp criticism in public opinion, in the press, as well as the dismissal in scholarship. The existing literature before my book was published is very limited. Scholars have dismissed the photoromance generally because they are considered, not just because in public opinion, because they're considered low culture, or if you want, trash culture. And they are dismissed as, I said, trite romantic narratives with very little also to give in terms of their aesthetics because of the fact that they recycle techniques from other media. And the same happened in scholarship, where the existing criticism was basically either talking about photoromances as tools of indoctrination or a tool of domination of capitalists, of the cultural industries, or dismissing them as women's literature. So I was interested in precisely in this contrast between, on one end, the great success and the very limited interest in scholarship and the sharp criticism in the press, which, by the way, was addressing not only the photoromance as an industry, but specifically the readers of photoromances, which were, and for a very long time, particularly women, and addressing these women readers of photoromances as naive or even plainly stupid. So from there, I decided that I wanted to read these photoromances myself to see what was the big deal about them. And as I was reading them, I realized that there was much more to tell about this story. And some of the criticism was pinpointing what, as I said, is a peculiar feature of photoromance, that is this transmedial aspect. There was a journalist on the Washington Post in the 1970s blaming photoromances for invading the U.S. market with a kind of pulp fiction that could be called a TV soap opera in magazine format. In fact, so this was, of course, an ironic commentary to reduce the importance of these imported products, but at the same time was highlighting the fact that you did have on the pages of these magazines the same content you could have in TV. So really pinpointing this kind of working across media platform. So as I was studying more, then I realized that the innovations that the Italian publisher had brought to the market in the late 40s and throughout the 50s and 60s were really worth scholarship attention, scholarly attention.
This is very interesting because just a few days ago, I think 2 days ago, I was reading about a misogynistic tweet storm on a feminist Italian politician, Laura Boldrini. In this tweet storm, the deputy director of the Italian newspaper Il Foglio, whose name is Maurizio Crippa, very openly insulted a woman who defended Boldrini, the politician, the feminist politician. And he tweeted in Italian, "più cretina della media, legga i fotoromanzi," which means more idiot than the average, go read photoromances. So clearly he meant, you are not worth, I don't want you as a reader. You can only read photoromances since you are stupid. And this is not a new phenomenon, not only, you know, in the critic, among the critics or the journalists, but just common people. They have considered the photoromances for a long time as a cheap, lowbrow commercial product for uneducated women. And you actually say very clearly that they were meant to be for the little servants, the servette. And so the photoromances have been mocked for a long time. And you, for instance, in your book mention Fellini's The White Sheikh, which revolves around a woman who is completely brainwashed by the photoromance industry. And here is when I need to talk about, you know, my guilt and my regret. So full disclosure, when I was young, not only was one of those photo romance critics who looked down at the women who read them, but I truly believed that photo romances were stupid and absolutely to avoid. So what I found really fascinating in your book is how you first reframe the natural association between the photo romance and women. So like female readers. And even more importantly, I find it really very interesting how you problematize this association and provide a feminist reading of the photo romance. So can you elaborate on this association and discuss how you reframe the photo romance in the book?
Yeah, I would like to start first going back to your quote of this tweet. I read the same tweet, and I was intrigued by the fact that the response, the male writer who is talking about this woman as a reader of photo romances and therefore someone with very little education and unable to actually intellectually challenge him, the way in which the woman who wrote the tweet before, the, on which that was commented by this man, she mentioned in her tweet the circus and comparing those who are involved in this discussion as people of the circus. So what I found interesting is that both of them, from, let's say, the two different sides of the aisle, are both using this association between what is labeled as low culture, so be it the circus or the photo romance, with the intellectual abilities of those who are the users or consumers of this product. So in a sense, they are using very much the same rhetoric, which is the rhetoric that precisely there is this association between the low culture and the users of this culture, because there is an assumption that viewers or readers, in this case of photo romances, are either passive receptacles or they don't have the ability for meaning making, right? For actually negotiating the meaning of what they read. So this is, I think, the starting point for the discussion in general about the photo romances and for my book as well. So on one hand, I was very interested in this practice that goes beyond the photo romance, in which associate generally type of media products that could be melodrama, the photo romance, pulp romances that have at the center sentimentality and romantic stories. And these are associated with the feminine gender. So there is a long tradition of this association, right? It's not just in the late 40s with the photo romance. It starts way before. And on the other hand, the fact that most of the analysis have started precisely from the perspective of the scholars, right, without taking into consideration the readers. In fact, in my book, I really found inspiration in a work that was published in the 1980s by Janet Stradway, a book about women readers of pulp romances, in which she does an ethnographic study on these readers. And she really talks about the way in which scholars do not acknowledge what the practice of reading, so buying, of sharing magazines, can do to women. And so beyond the narratives, which may very well be narratives that enforce the patriarchal heteronormative society in which women live, their narratives that are not transgressive, there is something else that goes on here that is other than simple identification, so that, you know, women, by reading stories that are about their oppression, they are therefore oppressed themselves, right? There is instead something about the way in which women can find time for themselves, can talk about themselves as they are talking about the stories that they've read with other readers like them, and create a collective identity by means of a reading, of practices of reading and buying and sharing. So this is, I think, where lies the feminist, you know, that's the feminist ground of my work. Understanding and trying to rewrite the history of the photo romance from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
That's really interesting. And going back to the tweet, actually, since you read it too, it's also interesting that the reader, the female reader, responded also when Maurizio Crippa asked her to go read photo romances. She also responded, okay, mi lancio, which means I will launch myself to read them. But it's a pun because Lancio is one of the most famous publishers of the photo romances. So she was actually, I don't know if she was a reader, but she was definitely a knowledgeable person about photo romances. Didn't you find it interesting?
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting. And you know, in my research, I've also tried to do sort of ethnographic study. Unfortunately, readers of photo romances of the 50s or 60s, there are no data about their responses to the text. But what I did, I studied fanship and fandom on social media today. So these mostly are today's readers of photo romances who began reading photo romance in the 1970s. And my research showed that a large number of these fans are in fact well educated, and they also have an understanding, awareness, a sort of, we could say, a sort of distance, right? So the criticism is very much often about fans, that there is so much proximity and there is this kind of irrational bond between the fan and the object of fandom, that it's impossible for them to think clearly, right? So I'm not at all surprised. I would not be surprised that this woman was actually, or in the past or today, a reader. But there was something else that I wanted to add, and you know, that goes back to what you were saying before about this sense of guilt that you know, either readers may have, or that you may have thinking about your past, right? And in the way in which you remember also considering the readers of photo romances as someone to look down at. What I found in my research is that, so there are several things. So on one hand, there is really this sense of shame that very much define readers of photo romances. And this sense of shame contrasts with what instead goes on the pages of the magazines, where fandom is very much nurtured, and nurtured really in a sense of creating a community of fans who are supportive of each other and understand their position and their taste, right? Another thing that I found out is about the connection between this sense of shame and the development of Italian society at the time, which is very much happening also throughout Europe and I would say throughout Western societies. There is a relationship between social status and habits of cultural consumption. And therefore, reading photo romances really becomes something that you would be ashamed of because it says something about your place in society. And therefore, for example, the association between them and the lower classes and the popular classes. So to a certain extent, then, the rejection of these media production has to do with a rejection of what they represent in terms of social status, and instead the acceptance of it or the desire to read them may also be seen as a way to precisely go against. For example, in the case of young readership in the 1970s, it's really a generational conflict in a conflict of between social classes, right? So you would have a large amount of readership from the middle class, young women from the middle class, who were consciously, you know, defined their parents and their middle class mentality by reading these kind of prohibited narratives that were considered for being for the lower classes.
Right. And It's also interesting that you say that the actual reader of the 50s are not here anymore to talk about what they did and what they thought and, you know, the pleasure or guilt or shame of the reading. But there are still some readers from the 70s, maybe, that you interviewed, or I don't know, I want to know more about that through Facebook and social media in general. So first of all, I would like to know how you approach them and which kind of method you use to interview them. And how large is this community today? To what extent you think is representative of past readers?
Yeah, so I really want to respond to your question, but I do have to go back to take a step back here because it is fair to say that it would be hard now to interview, and in my research, most of the people responded to my surveys were readers of who began in the 1970s. However, it is very different, of course, to talk about memory, right? And to instead try to study the readership of the time, right? So it's really also in kind of a historical question. So the way that in the book I address the readership at the time is by looking at the magazines and looking at those aspects of the magazine that could be editorial strategies, that could be letter writing. Which also includes the narrative themselves, as very often photoromances represented fans themselves, right? So through the study of the texts themselves in their context and through the studies of the practices of production and distribution, understand what was the readership at the time and how did the readership contributed to the industry in an active way, in such active way that we can precisely see readers as producers of meaning and not just a receptacle of some form of indoctrination by means of these narratives. Instead, as you said, part of my book is also focused on what we can call an ethnography, that is an ethnographic study that happens online for the most part. So I created a survey that I distributed through social media. I did research on Facebook groups that are currently active, Facebook groups of fans of photoromances, particularly fans of these Roman publisher and series of by this Roman publisher, Lancio. I became a member of these groups and I began to have a relationship with the members, conversations about their culture. So on one hand, I collected data by means of anonymous survey. And on the other hand, I collected particularly qualitative data by means of conversation with these readers and fans. In order to understand how today photoromance fandom is developed and happens. And what I found is precisely, as I said, on one hand, the memory of this readership of the 1970s is one that has a lot to do with the generational conflict at the time, which is not political in the sense that it does not take into consideration what was happening in those years. So the 70s is a time of great radical movement and feminism and even terrorism. So none of that is in the memory of the readers, but the way in which they are political is by, and specifically I'm talking about women here because most of my respondents are women or identify as women. Of course, the anonymity of the web also help them create their own identity more creatively, if you want. They really have a memory of becoming fans because of a desire to, of course, be part of a community, but also challenging their middle class parents at the same time.
Yeah, the more you speak, the more I also think about a parallel field of research I'm exploring at this time, which is the B movies like the camerotici in the 60s, late 60s and 70s. And I actually, in some focus groups that I organized, I caught this idea of shame among people who were trying to hide behind the idea that, you know, they didn't belong to that community that was watching those films because it was from, you know, there were people from a different social class, basically. But then everybody, and I'm talking about the male audiences, actually, everybody had watched them. So it would be really interesting to, you know, to compare this kind of, these two lines of research from this perspective. But what I find really innovative in your book is how you change the critical perspective on the photoromance by expanding the analysis, as you already said, from a genre to a complex medium, because in the book you go far beyond the analysis of the narrative and aesthetic features of the photoromance. You go completely beyond the canonical analysis. You analyze elements such as the transmedialization, you have already mentioned that, but also the reader's tastes and participation, their consumerism, the fandom element, the editorial and production strategies. So in this complexity, it is this complexity that allows you to show how the photoromance is in line with the gender discourses developed in Western European democracies, particularly with post-feminism. So that's something, it looks like that, you know, the photoromance from your perspective becomes a sort of a precursor of modern products. And it's a sort, you analyze it as a sort of transmedia feminist, from a sort of transmedia feminist historical perspective. So can you talk about this kind of reconciliation of feminism and post-feminism through photoromances in your book?
Yeah, and in a way I can kind of, again, go back to what you were saying right now about this subgenre of the sexy comedies of the 70s. As a matter of fact, the case of the photoromance is very different because the photoromance is very much a child of its time. So it's not marginal at all. So we're talking about magazines that were sold millions of copies per week, and about magazines that were really grounded in the culture of consumerism, which was the culture of the time that target for the most, the target especially a female audience. So in that sense, the photoromance is really the perfect lens through which to study how consumerist culture developed in Italy and then throughout, as well as throughout Europe in the post-war period. So speaking from this point of view, then the relationship between the success of the photoromance and the growing importance of women as consumers at the time is crucial, right? So as I like to say in the book, quoting Simone de Beauvoir, the photoromance was not born a woman's magazine. It became one. And it became one because at the time, publishers understood that to specialize was a perfect strategy in order to monetize precisely on the growing liberties that women had at the time, particularly in purchasing power. So the economic independence that women were experiencing in Italy as well. And so surprisingly enough, for example, a doxa, so a statistics of the time showed that 90% of readers of these magazine published by Bolero, by Mondadori, Bolero Film, were women. And these women did not consider themselves the head of the household. However, they were the one buying photoromances. They were the one making the purchase, right? Which tells, and they were the one that even though they belonged to the low middle class, they had, according to these statistics, a great chance to grow economically, right? To climb the social ladder. So the readers then of these magazines were women whose growing independence in the economy went hand in hand with their emancipation in society, and with especially what then in the late 60s will become more prominently the process of sexual liberation. So reading the, to go back, you know, to this idea of shame, this idea of shame is really a social construction. It's actually a construction by the end of a male-centered, heteronormative culture, elite culture of the time. Because if you read the magazine, you realize that the model of femininity represented there are very much not traditional. They're very much really, again, emblematic of the time. And very often you have young girls who work, they have extramarital relationship. So from the point of view, especially of sexuality, what this magazine conveyed to their female readers were models that did not match with the traditional and patriarchal society that both political and cultural elite wanted to maintain. So in this way, they were very much transgressive. And at the same time, I use the term post-feminist because they were filled with contradictions. And these contradictions were, they originated because of the fact that on one hand, both the magazines in general, so we're talking also about advertisement for beauty products, we're talking about columns that talked about advice that talked about sentimental relationship, together with the content of the narratives of the phototextual narratives of the photo romances, they presented a model of woman that was sexually liberated, and at the same time, a model of woman that aspired at the ideal of marriage and love. So this kind of contradiction, a scholar in cultural studies, Angela McRobbie, talks about a double entanglement. So this peculiar to the model of femininity that is born out of consumer culture in the late 40s and 50s, and that is very common and predominant throughout Western Europe. And so the photo romance in Italy really is a very good way to understand how, even though McRobbie talks about post-feminism, it is in fact a model that originates way before the radical movements of the 1970s. Another scholar, Hilary Radner, talks about, in fact, something she calls it neo-feminism, and because she wants to draw the attention to the fact that it's a type of women's emancipation that goes side by side and actually before that that was promoted by radical feminism later in the 1970s.
That's fascinating. And going back to the my disclosure, we've been talking about shame, but I also mentioned regret. Regret of not being aware of how the photo romances were transgressive, actually, because I really never got in close touch, in close vicinity. So this is the problem. And so for this reason, I really loved your chapter on the Cold War photo romances. First of all, because it has a wonderful visual apparatus, especially that section. I enjoyed it, really looking at it very much. But it was, it was not only entertaining, because this chapter is about the struggle, and I'm quoting you, the struggle for women's minds and how photo romances could be used for educational, political, and edifying goals from many different directions, I mean, contradictory directions. To me, it was really phenomenal to see the Catholic and communist photo romances vis-a-vis, and even the birth control campaign as a photo romance. It was amazing. Can you talk about the channels of distribution of these specific photo romances? How successful were they? How diffused were they?
Yes, so these are very good examples of productions that were sponsored by political, religious agencies. The one you mentioned was sponsored by the birth control movement in Italy to promote the use of the contraception pill. So they used the medium of the photoromance, so this type of means of communication, because they wanted to target, first of all, the same target audience of photoromance, that is women, because they wanted to use photographs as a way to attract the readers and also, of course, the easy kind of reading, right? The limited amount of reading combined with the photograph. So in terms of, so in general, they wanted to use the same techniques because these techniques have been proven successful with the same target audience. As a matter of fact, other agencies also outside of Italy understood that the popularity of photoromances was to be exploited. So in the book, I also talk about the Peace Corps, for example, used photo novels to educate Ecuadorian peasants on how to create to grow plants in Ecuador. So that is to say that basically what happens is that these different agencies understand that a way to reach the audience would be to use the same tools that until yesterday they criticized very much, right? But using them in a different way. What happens is then when you look at these uses of the photoromances, you realize that precisely what I said before, their success is not just due to the techniques. This success is due to the fact that they are embedded in the culture of consumerism of the time. And so when you take them out of that context, the success, it doesn't happen, right? It doesn't have the same kind of effect. And the very good case is precisely the photoromances made by the Communist Party, right? And specifically, for example, because of the fact that they don't use celebrities, they don't use movie stars the same way in which Bolero film would use, right? Attracting readers because these readers were familiar with other media, with the cinema, with television, and they wanted to continue enjoying the same stories, the same narrative world, and the same characters also on the pages of the magazine, and then vice versa, right? So what I mentioned before, the kind of connection between the magazines and other media, it's really what made them successful. And without that, you wouldn't have the same effects.
Yeah, and the proximity to other media like film goes back to the beginning, actually, because I read with surprise, that Cesare Zavattini, one of the sacred names of neorealism, who worked with Vittorio De Sica, the director of Bicycle Thieves and so many films, among those in some way involved in the photoromances industry. So, but you point out that actually, he had a sort of a peculiar, you call it ambiguous position in this industry. Can you explain that?
Yeah, his position is very typical of leftist intellectual at the time, meaning that on one hand, Zavattini was involved, for example, in the making of a photoromance that was published by Mondadori in 1962. The title was The Guilt, La Colpa, and it was about this woman who happened to be pregnant before marriage. So he was involved as a maker of photoromances. He was interviewed several times in like documentary films talking about them, but always with this attitude of a pedagogical mission. That was very common. Before I mentioned that in the public opinion and in the press, there were critics of photoromance as tools of indoctrination or stultifying tools, but also there was this kind of condescendence. And Zavattini was one of those, one of those who would say, you know, photoromances are good as long as intellectuals can use them to educate the readers. So again, with this kind of understanding of an audience that needs to be educated from the top down, and that is otherwise stultified, right, by the messages of the cultural industries.
Yeah, and continuing to talk about this proximity with the film industry, you also discuss another aspect. Actually, you historicize it, the relationship between photo romances and stardom. The stars, the celebrities. So who are the stars of the photo romances?
Yeah, the relationship with cinema is really fascinating and is at various levels. So in the book, I talk about this particular kind of photo romance that is called cine romance. These are a kind of photo romances that adapt or translate, let's say, films on the pages. So you would have photo romances based on a variety of films from, of course, the film melodrama of the time, but also films by auteur of the period. You would have a photo romance of Antonioni's La Ventura or photo romance of the Sica's Terminal Station. So here there is a really direct connection, and these magazines are very much targeting both movie lovers, movie fans, and those who could not, for example, go to the movie theater but wanted to watch their favorite movie star on page, right? So in a way, movie stars are really, they migrate from cinema to the pages of photo romances. They were also hired as actors instead in photo romances that were original stories, that were not adaptation of films. And by the way, the cine romances really use film stills and screenshots from the movie, and then the page was recomposing the story for the readers. Or they were hired as actors, and some of them actually, like Gina Lollobrigida or Sophia Loren, they were first actress in photo romances before they became movie stars. And then in the 1970s, instead, you have a very different phenomenon with this series by the Roman company Lancio, where you have what we can call in-house celebrities. So differently from the 50s and the 60s, when really readers of photo romances were also movie fans or TV viewers, and so they wanted to enjoy their characters from the small screen to the big screen and vice versa. In the 70s, the type of fandom that Lancio generated was one that really was attached to the actors and actresses that were made popular by the publisher themselves. So the famous name was Franco Gaspari, who was really a star and someone who then tried to also become an actor in movies, but was very much known because as an actor of in photo romances. And this kind of attachment to these celebrities is again typical of other media like soap operas, right? You have this same kind of relationship with figure that otherwise are not known, right? If I say Franco Gaspari, most people will not know who he is, right? But if you are a fan of photo romances, you very well know who he is, and most likely you are one of his greatest fans.
It's really interesting that actually you mentioned the screenshots used from screenshots from the films used for new photo romances, because today that would be a violation of the copyright, right? And actually, you discuss that in the book. You're talking about the pirates, photo romances as the pirates of film industry, because they recycled the film narratives and titles as they wished. And so in the book, you also do a quite thorough analysis of Senso, a photo romance inspired by director Luchino Visconti's eponymous film, Senso. So can you talk about this relationship, and what about the copyright? I mean, what happened? How was this issue managed?
Yeah, this is a very fascinating topic, and it's actually a question that a lot of people have asked me, and then therefore I looked into it precisely because everyone I was talking to mentioning the fact that the film like Senso would have a printed version that used exactly the same screenshot from the film but rewrote the story, because it's important to say that the story that the photo romance tell is not quite the same as the story that the film tells. So most people would really be puzzled, how did that happen? happen. Clearly, directors had no idea, film stars had no idea that their films were turned into photo romances. And because of the association between photo romance and low culture, I wonder whether they would be happy knowing that happened. So the reason lies in the copyright laws of the time. And so what I do in the book is I investigate how the photo romance was not part of the copyright law and therefore was not really persecuted for doing something like adapting Antonioni's La Notte into a photo romance. And particularly film stars at the time had no rights over their images. In directors, most likely they just gave up their rights to producer at the time. So if a producer agreed with a publisher, in the case, for example, of a cine romance series that was owned by Dino De Laurenti, who was also a film producer, it was very easy for the producer to give, you know, the right to the publisher, especially when the publisher was owned by himself, to make these products. So this is also something that says a lot. So it goes beyond, let's say, the photo romance to understand what was happening with regard to the so-called, auteur of the time and how much was really the power that they had over their films. So the cine romance was outside of the copyright law, and that allowed, therefore, this kind of practice that I called pirating, right? And so what happens, though, the positive aspect of it, which is also an aspect that we can connect again to this idea of convergence culture, is the fact that it allowed then, especially small publishers, like those who were really at the margins of the publishing market, to a kind of freedom that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And so a film like Senso was adapted for the printed page in a way that really changed the narrative from the original one and changed it, adapting it to the taste of its readers. So very often, for example, films were turned into sentimental stories. So there is a cine romance based on Antonioni's Il Grido. And if you've ever seen the film, you would not, and if you have never seen Antonioni's film, you wouldn't think it's necessarily a melodrama, right? But the way in which it would be adapted for as a photo romance would be to focus then on the love stories of the main protagonist, sometimes really changing the core meaning of the film. And in the case of Senso also, it showed how, because of the liberties that this publisher had, they could show, they could talk about topics that may have been censored if it were a film. And so they escaped. At the time, there was a very strict film commission that was examining film in order to give permission to be released. And this kind of commission, of course, would not pay attention to cine romances. And therefore, if we think about, again, these magazines' relation to their female readers and in the way in which they could present model of conducts, there could be space there for presenting model of conducts that were not necessarily those that the censorship commission would have accepted would have deemed as acceptable.
That's so interesting. It couldn't happen today, I guess, but it was amazing as a cultural phenomenon. So I still have a sort of maybe a final question, because while listening to you and reading the book and going back to my young years, I was trying to grapple with this contradiction of seeing the photo romances as instrumental to educate women on either side of the spectrum, and also they proposed gender and sexual models, so therefore they were at least in some parts of the production maybe instrumental to the patriarchal culture hierarchies. On the other hand, the audiences were exposed to and could interact with the female desire and sexuality, this kind of transgressive ideas of the birth control or extramarital relationships, kind of liberated women. So at least some of the production was very progressive. And so we could consider the photo romances also as safe spaces, especially for female audiences. So what could you say just to reconcile again this contradiction, or maybe how would you frame this spectrum of instances of productions of ideas?
Well, you know, I would say that precisely the whole point of the book is to bring up these contradictions. And so the goal is really not to reconcile them as much as to dismantle a univocal way of looking at photo romances. So as I said, the main critique were very a one-way criticism. These are just stupid magazines. Let's trash them, right? So the point is to bring up these contradictions and understand the way in which, because of them, there could be nuances in our readings, and there could be also, you know, multiple ways of interpretation from the point of view of readers. So as I described before, this kind of coexistence on one end of conservative gender roles and on the other hand, a representation of sexuality that is liberated. It's very typical of the time, and it's very typical also today of contemporary rom-coms or other so-called girly films or women's films. And it is typical of a gender discourse and a discourse of sexuality that we call today post-feminist, as I said before. So in a sense, I precisely resist the idea that we have to reconcile them, or that their existence is somehow a sign that we're not reading them right. But rather, precisely that this is the reading that allows us to understand better what the magazine have to say about the culture and society is of in Italy and throughout Europe in the post-war period, and understand the role that individuals have within this context.
Yeah, and also how they contributed to the creation of this culture, to this culture in general in those years, I guess. Would you like to add anything that we didn't discuss about your book?
Oh, I think we have discussed so thoroughly. Well, if I want to add something is that definitely the book has the book is structured so that to touch upon various questions, and the focus is as I said, the photo romances, these magazines, but really someone who has an interest in cinema, who has an interest in television, who has an interest in digital media could find something worth reading. So, and I really hope, you know, my hope is that, you know, it would be too much to think that one book is enough. Nobody would ever dare to write a book titled The Cinema today, right? So I did title mine The Photo Romance because there is really not much written about it, but my hope is that it would serve as a starting point for many more discussion and many more rewriting of the same story by other scholars.
Yeah, we really hope so. Paola, thank you very much for this amazing and interesting conversation, and also especially for your book. It's really a great reading. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
Yeah, it was. Bye.